The Lewis gun. Actually, this is about Isaac Lewis, because you really have to go through the man's life and his trials and tribulations to understand the background of the Lewis machine gun, which is, of course, the lightest machine gun in World War I. Now, Isaac Lewis was born in 1858 in Pennsylvania, but later on his family moved to Kansas. Initially, as he grew up, he wanted to be a teacher, but after taking a series of tests, he ends up taking the West Point entrance exam and scored near the top of it. So he ended up going to West Point in the Army. And, of course, his specialty was engineering. So, you know, that's what he graduates from West Point as, of course, as an engineer. In 1884, 4 years after his graduation, Lewis created the world's first successful artillery range and position finder. And Lewis promptly offered it, the patent, for free to the United States Army, which, of course, said it didn't have any value and turned it down. During the Spanish-American War in 1898, the Army purchased the exact same system from a arms company for millions of dollars when they could have had it for free. Now, Lewis had sold his invention for a few hundred dollars to this company after he'd offered it to the military for free. And this really incensed them. And one of the things about Lewis, it's a good thing he was really good at what he did, because I think they would have court-martialed him. He was not afraid to complain openly, loudly, and go over his superior's head when he thought something was wrong. And what he was complaining about after this fiasco for the government in 1898 was, he's complaining about what is called the ordnance ring. This is a good old boy network, which means, you know, you do something for me and I'll do something for you. You have arms manufacturers and the senior officers who then decided what to buy, and the two kind of work together. Okay? In 1902, Lewis's complaining finally made it to the press and eventually to the U.S. Senate. And the Congress passed laws to try and fix the problem. Of course, Lewis is still in the Army, and his commanding officer, one of the men who he went over his head, who was part of the ordnance ring, was General Crozier. To some extent, he was the head of the procurement department. Well, as a result, Lewis is, shall we say, remotely assigned. It's a term they will use. I think they usually called it limbo posting in those days. So they put him in a remote location and had him working on obsolete stuff that really wouldn't have any. Well, the hope is that he just gets sick of it and then resign. Okay. But in 1904, General Leonard Wood and General Nelson brought him back to Washington, D.C. and convinced, you know, everybody to leave him alone, let him do what he does. And he then patented several items, and anything that had military value, he just gave to the government. In 1911, at the age of 52, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel. And then shortly thereafter, he retired. Now, when he retired, he was offered a job by the Automatic Arms Company. But before he took it, he went and cleared everything with the War Department before he took the job. Can you imagine that today? Having somebody in the military-industrial complex, after they retire, coming in and saying, can I go and work for this company? Can I go and work for that company? Today, we expect them to just go. We sometimes assume that they're already working for them while they're here. Well, Automatic Arms had a project, and what they wanted was to construct a light machine gun. Now, they had a prototype. They had a design that had been done by Samuel McLean. And it was a water-cooled gun with a top-mounted drum. And what Lewis did was he used his air-cooled system and married it to it. So when you're not using the water-cooled system, it made it lighter and easier to do. And so Lewis's gun ends up being the best of both designs. It was an air-cooled device with a top-mounted drum, and then he had other modifications to it. Now, on June the 7th, 1912, a public test was held, and two aviators, with Isaac Lewis and the press, and of course appropriate government officials, came to see the gun fired from a plane. It actually ends up being the first machine gun ever fired from a plane. And the observers on the ground were stunned by its success. And when you figure that it only weighed 26 pounds and could be used and actually carried by a single man, it was astounding. Now, there actually ends up being two versions of the Lewis gun. There's a 47-round Army version, and then later on the Air version has 97 rounds. And they also take there's an aluminum device on the barrel, which helped to create the air system. That's removed for the Air version, which lightens it, knocks it down to 19 pounds when you remove it. And now when you compare the weight, okay, the Lewis gun at its heaviest weighs 26 pounds. The Colt weighed 93. The Vickers weighed 68. Maxims weighed 115. The Binet Mercier weighed 30 pounds. So you figure this is a good deal. Well, no, it isn't. Because guess who's still in charge of procurement for the Army? It's General Crozier. And he wants nothing to do with it. He claimed that Lewis was making private profit. And Lewis's response was, quote, "Let my government use for free the best machine gun in the world. And I, Isaac Lewis, will not accept 1 cent for it." Well, Crozier, you know, who has the power to stop any deal, was simply getting his revenge. And he ends up delaying by using red tape and various testing delays. He kept the Army from getting it, the U.S. Army from getting it until 1917. And it took a congressional investigation to finally get the Army to be allowed to procure it. Now, the Marines, which were not under Crozier's control, they took it immediately. They took it in 1912. And, of course, there were British and other observers there. The Belgians and the British adopted it in 1914. By 1916, there were 45,000 Lewis guns in use on the Western Front. The German nickname for it is the Belgian rattlesnake. It's a mess. So, the company is making plenty of money and so forth and so on. However, when the U.S. declared war, the Army only had 353 machine guns to their name, and 12 of those were Civil War Gatling guns. And by the time the United States Army's first order, which was for 1,300 guns, was sent to Automatic Arms, they couldn't make them. They were full. They were making all they could make for the British. And so what the company did is they gave the Savage Arms Company the right to produce these British orders. Now, there was a factory in Belgium. There was a factory in France that were used to manufacture these as well, but they also made them here in the States, and are still under U.S. patent. The first, what was supposed to happen, the Savage Arms Company would then take over producing all the British orders, and the Automatic Arms would then concentrate on making American orders. And, of course, part of the business with the congressional investigation is, of course, Lewis, again, widely complained. You know, he said, look, I have two sons, and I'm going to tell you right now that they are not getting the best equipment. And eventually a check was written to him for almost $11,000, and he refused. He signed it and gave it back. So he never made a penny off the sales. Now, when the first U.S. troops reached Europe, they weren't given a Lewis gun. They were given a French machine gun called a Chauchat, which was not very good. But eventually they would get them. But frequently, through most of the war, the Army troops had to, procure them by diverse methods. One method is that all the units were trained with the Lewis gun. So when they arrived, they were given a machine gun they weren't familiar with. So once that was found out, then you have the units. And I think the first two units that did this were the 5th and 6th Marines. While they were doing their training, they grabbed the Lewis guns, disassembled them, and smuggled them bit by bit to France, and then reassembled them. And then you have several National Guard units to do exactly the same thing. Of course, you would trade for them. You would barter for them with other troops. And as I said, you know, there's a light aircraft version. Now, American pilots didn't have this problem. Because you see, American pilots are flying French and British planes because we don't have any American airplanes. They were all shot down or crashed during the chasing of Pancho Villa in the AEF excursion in the northern Mexico with General Pershing. So they came equipped. So there are some pilots who periodically would lose their Lewis guns. See, the sweet thing about the Lewis gun on an airplane, if you know anything about the machine guns on those planes, if that plane goes down, they're far, you can't get them off the plane. Now, it's not the main gun. You're not going to use a Lewis gun for the main gun because the magazine round's too small with 97. But it's a back weapon. It's an observer weapon. But it's on a pylon. So if you crash land, you can pull the pin on the pylon, lift the gun up, and then get out of the plane, and you have a weapon, a significant weapon that you can use. And since it only weighs 19 pounds. But yeah, the French used to complain that, you know, the Americans seem to lose a lot of these machine guns. Of course, they're unpopping them and sending them down to the Army guys. Now, after World War One, the Lewis gun, to some extent, revolutionized armored cars because they were light enough that you could use them on armored cars and that you could put a lot of them on an armored car. Now, Lewis himself dies in 1929. But his legacy continues for a while. So in the 20s and 30s, almost every army still used them. And then they went into the armored cars. During World War II, you still found some being used, but it was replaced by the Brownie automatic rifle at that point. From 1946 to 1956, the Israeli army used it, and they actually found some old Lewis guns with Viet Cong units during the Vietnam War as late as 1971. So it's been around for a while. At the Liberty Memorial Museum, I think they have three of them setting out with, all of them have the Army version with the aluminum tube. But I know they have one that's designed for the airplane because I have a picture of it from the old exhibit. Now, as far as sources on this, The Lewis Gun by Truby, The Social History of the Machine Gun by Ellis, Machine Guns 14th Century to Present by Hogg, that's H-O-G-G, and then this is an article, it's a military history article from the 90s, 15 Million Rounds a Day by Truby. So I hope you enjoyed that. Don't forget to come by the website, sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, and check out the CDs. Thank you very much.